Good afternoon. I call to order this meeting of education policy. Our first order of business is approval of the minutes. And there is a quorum present, by the way. Yep, we have convened. All right, our first order of business, approval of the minutes from Wednesday, February 14th. Representative Feist, have you had the opportunity to review the minutes, and would you make the motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I've read them word for word, and I would like to move the minutes.
Thank you. We appreciate that, because sometimes there are corrections that need to be made, and this would be the time to get them. Thank you, Representative Feist. Any discussion on the minutes from February 14th? Hearing none. We will approve the minutes from February 14th. All in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Nay. All right. Minutes are approved. Thank you. All right. Do we have our first bill? Yes, we do. Our first bill is House File 2208 and Representative Norris. If you'll join us. Our intention today is to hear the bill from Representative Norris. I know it's one that there's been a lot of interest in, but our intent is to lay it over for further consideration after the meeting today. And Representative Frazier, would you motion Representative Norris's bill 2208 before the committee to be laid over for further consideration?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Well, we're all set then. Representative Norris, introduce yourself for the committee, and I believe you have an amendment that you would like to introduce at the same time to get the bill in the order that you would like to present it in. So if you can introduce yourself, and then we'll bring forward the amendment. And again, I think Representative Frazier can move the amendment for you.
Great. Well, good afternoon, Chair Pryor and members of the committee. I'm Representative Matt Norris. I represent the Blaine and Lexington area here in the Minnesota House. And as you mentioned, Chair Pryor, I do have an author's amendment, the A1 amendment. What this amendment does is essentially moves all the dates in the bill back 1 year. We introduced the bill last year. We're now hearing it a year later. And so just for practicality, it makes sense to kind of shift everything back by a year.
Thank you. Representative Frazier, would you please move the A1 amendment?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Thank you. All right. Any discussion of the A1 amendment as Representative Norris has just explained it? All right. Seeing no discussion, we will vote on the A1 amendment. All in favor, please say aye.
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 Those opposed? All right. The amendment is passed. All right. Representative Norris, please proceed and present your bill as amended.
Great. Thanks, Chair Pryor. Chair Pryor, members, this is a bill that I'm excited to bring forward to you today because it actually is something that I started working on before I was even a member of the legislature. Back when I was an advocate working at Youth Prize, we went through a pretty extensive process to develop a new policy agenda. We talked with young people across the state. We talked with allied organizations, and one of the issues that came to our attention was these disparities between the types of students who are enrolled in accelerated coursework here in Minnesota. And Minnesota isn't unique in this regard, but you know, it kind of makes sense. You know, when I think back to my own educational experience, oftentimes the way that I got enrolled and you know, my classmates got enrolled in accelerated coursework was either a teacher, tapped you on the shoulder and said, you might be a good fit for this honors class or this AP class. Or you had a parent who, was advocating and knew how to navigate the system and knew which, courses were available and advocated to get you enrolled in an advanced course. And we know, that relying on that process simply, introduces the risk of implicit bias, which can create disparities. It means that, students who may not have parents who are able to navigate that system as well, they may not be able to enroll in that advanced coursework as easily. And so, you end up with the disparities that we see here in our state. We know that white students are overrepresented in these advanced courses, and our Black, Latino, and low-income students are underrepresented. For instance, Black students, they account for 11% of the high school population, but only 7% of students taking AP courses. Similarly, Latino students are 10% of a high school student body, but only 6% of students are taking concurrent enrollment courses. Participation in rigorous coursework across the board has declined, unfortunately, since the start of the pandemic, but we've seen especially big decreases for low-income students. AP course participation in the state has dropped 20%. It's 41% for low-income students. Similarly, for concurrent enrollment, it's dropped 1% for all public school students here in the state. It's dropped 28% for low-income students. And so there's clearly a need for us to try to find a better way to do that. And this bill seeks to address that fact that many students are overlooked and never given the chance to enroll. It builds on a model that's working in other states to level the playing field in terms of who's placed in and recommended for these courses. I mentioned, you know, other states. We have six states, Colorado, Nevada, North Carolina, Washington, and Texas, and Illinois, that have passed policies similar to this that aim to prevent students from falling through the cracks by using what's called automatic enrollment. Essentially, it removes the bias and expands opportunities for defaulting students into more rigorous course options if they demonstrate that they have met or exceeded state standards. And they can do that in this bill in one of two ways, either through demonstrated performance on a standardized test or by achieving a high grade in one of the prerequisite courses for that advanced coursework. There's evidence that these policies work. You look at Tacoma Public Schools, where they implemented this. They saw their enrollment in advanced classes more than double, and for students of color, enrollment tripled from 20% to 60%. And the superintendent there says this policy not only led to more students taking advanced classes and passing the exams, but with more students graduating and enrolling in post-secondary classes as well. So with that, Chair Pryor, I've got a lot of folks who are a lot more knowledgeable about this than I do, some national experts who are ready to testify about how this could benefit Minnesota.
All right. Thank you, Representative Norris. And I believe we have two remote testifiers that we'll begin with. First, Dr. Kristen Hengen, Senior Policy Analyst. If you can hear us, please unmute and introduce yourself again for the committee and begin your testimony.
Okay, thank you so much, Chair Pryor and members of the committee. My name is Kristen Hengen, and I'm a senior policy analyst at the Education Trust in Washington, D.C. We're a national nonprofit that works to close opportunity gaps that disproportionately affect students of color and students from low-income backgrounds. And I conduct research and policy analyses on state and federal efforts to increase access to advanced coursework. So research says that when students have access to advanced coursework opportunities, they have higher confidence, are more engaged in school, and have higher graduation rates. And advanced coursework allows students to earn credits and credentials in high school so they can get a head start in college in their career. But unfortunately, current access to advanced coursework is inequitable in many schools across the country. Generally, as Representative Norris said, students are placed in advanced courses through educator or even counselor or parent recommendation, or they need to opt in. And when placement is tied to just educator recommendation, often educators recommend students who fit their personal idea of what an advanced student is, and that's often students who look like them. This has resulted in decades of under-enrollment of capable Black and Latino and Native American students, as well as students from low-income backgrounds, students with disabilities, and English learners in advanced classes. And this is not because there aren't students capable of success, and this policy is not about putting students in classes they aren't ready for. Rather, we have data to show that Black and Latino students are successful in advanced courses when given the opportunity. And we also have data to show there are many more students ready for advanced coursework than many educators think. So this is about connecting students ready for rigor with a challenge. Automatically opting students into advanced coursework when they show readiness is a relatively simple policy lever that has been enormously effective in enrolling more underserved students in advanced classes. North Carolina and Washington both have had automatic enrollment policies for several years and have some impressive data to show for it, including advanced classes that are nearly demographically representative of their schools. And districts in Central Texas, who are the impetus for that state's newest opt-out policy, eliminated racial disparities in access to advanced math through their own automatic enrollment policies. Again, the concern is that there are students showing readiness on an end-of-year exam in sixth grade, for example, but they aren't making it into advanced math in eighth grade, and those students are usually students of color. So, as Representative Norris said, three other states have automatic enrollment policies, and fortunately, we're seeing a lot of bipartisan interest in other districts and states across the country. And Minnesota's bill can help schools identify students showing readiness for advanced courses who are not being identified through traditional means. And this doesn't mean reliance on one test score, even though we do have data that shows even that single measure can expand access to students who show readiness but have been kept out of advanced opportunities. The test score raises the floor but doesn't lower the ceiling. The policy also encourages districts to use multiple measures of eligibility to automatically enroll students. That may be a class grade of a B or higher or a certain PSAT score in some other states. And in addition to some other considerations, there can be measures like student ambition or self-nomination to consider. Minnesota's policy also comes with necessary changes for schools. Schools must partner with families and share information, be prepared to offer more advanced classes, and provide resources to students who may need a little extra support. By helping schools offer more advanced opportunities and get more students in those classes, Minnesota can reduce historic barriers to advanced classes, address hidden systemic inequities, and build a more diverse workforce for the state. So these disparities in access to advanced coursework are not inevitable. State leaders, as well as district and school leaders, can take meaningful steps to put Minnesota on the path to fair representation by implementing evidence-based solutions that advance access to and success in advanced coursework. If we hope to get more Minnesotans ready for college and the workforce, this bill can provide that opportunity. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have Mariah Taylor Knighton, a student from the University of Minnesota. And if you can hear us, please unmute, identify yourself for the record, and please proceed.
Good afternoon, Chair Pryor and committee members. My name is Maria Taylor Knighton. I am a second-year student at the University of Minnesota. I am here in support of House File 2208. During my time at Como Park Senior High, I had the privilege of taking accelerated college prep courses that prepared me with the necessary experiences, resources, and knowledge needed to thrive once I got to college. Although I didn't do PSEO, I took AP Human Geography, AP World History, and CIS first-year writing courses. I greatly appreciated being given the opportunity to take on more challenging courses, and I thrived in learning environments that required more time and effort. Having access to those classes helped me in understanding that there are no limits on knowledge, and when students are given the opportunity to prove to themselves and others that they are capable of doing well in rigorous courses. Every child deserves to be given the opportunity to engage in meaningful learning that will provide them with lifelong skills and knowledge. During my time taking these courses, I noticed that they were heavily based more so on teacher and counselor recommendations than the actual student's proficiency the year before. Due to this, it made it difficult to create a diverse classroom. Because of this, I am in support of this bill because I know how it feels to be discounted, not due to my grades or achievements, but the color of my skin. And I know many of my peers felt the same. This bill will give students many more opportunities to go beyond what is expected of them to succeed. I greatly appreciate your time and allowing me to speak today.
Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story. We appreciate it hearing from
Thank you.
I believe you have an in-person testifier at this point.
Yes, Chair Pryor. All right.
I see on my list Dr. Megan Austin, Principal Researcher from American Institute for Research. And if you can introduce yourself for the committee, and please proceed.
Absolutely. Thank you, Chair Pryor and members of the committee. My name is Megan Austin, and I'm a principal researcher at the American Institutes for Research, which is a nonpartisan, not-for-profit institution based in Arlington, Virginia. I'm also a St. Paul resident. I lead a study funded by the U.S. Department of Education that examined the effects of academic acceleration in Washington State on students' advanced course enrollments, GPAs, and high school graduation rates. I'm here to share findings from that study that may inform ongoing decision-making about automatic enrollment here in Minnesota. Between 2014 and 2016, more than 70 of about 250 Washington districts chose to adopt an academic acceleration policy as part of a statewide grant program. District policies automatically enrolled 11th and 12th grade students with a proficient score on high school standardized tests in English and math into a dual credit advanced course in the relevant subject. For example, AP English rather than regular English, dual enrollment or concurrent enrollment pre-calc instead of regular pre-calculus. Our key takeaway from this study is that academic acceleration increased participation and created more equitable access to advanced courses for students who previously had been overlooked, and it did so without harming student performance. The policy increased enrollments in advanced math courses, primarily for students with a proficient math test score. The policy also increased advanced course enrollments in English and social studies, and any advanced course in any subject, and not just for students with a proficient test score. These findings indicate that when implementing their policies, districts likely relied more heavily on test scores in math, but looked beyond standardized test scores in other advanced courses to identify students with the potential to succeed. Both approaches increased access to advanced courses and narrowed enrollment differences for students who have historically been underrepresented in advanced courses, namely students from low-income families and students who are Black, Hispanic, and from other underrepresented racial and ethnic groups. As enrollments increased in advanced courses for students both with and without a proficient test score, students' GPAs in core academic subjects and their graduation rates largely remained stable. GPAs for students with a proficient test score and students from historically underrepresented groups, regardless of their test scores, actually increased slightly. Stability is a positive outcome here. As students moved into more challenging courses, they performed just as well as in their prior courses and without sacrificing performance in other subjects. Although math enrollments and math GPAs increased for all qualified students from historically advantaged backgrounds had slightly larger increases than other qualified students. Given the more structured nature of math course sequences, increasing advanced math access sooner than 11th or 12th grade is particularly important to further increase equity. But even with its focus on later high school grades, Washington's policy outcomes demonstrate that automatically enrolling students can increase access for many students who have been overlooked for advanced opportunities, but who are ready to meet that challenge. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. We'll now go to member discussion. Representative Weiss.
Thank you. This sounds like a great program, I'm persuaded. I just had like a really technical question that maybe Tim Strum might be the best person, or Christina Parra. I noticed on page 3, line 24, that the data that the program will collect must be disaggregated by race and ethnicity, eligibility for free and reduced price meals, and special education status. And I was just curious if that is still helpful in a post-universal meals world to collect data that way.
Mr. Strong.
Chair Pryor, Representative Feist, even though Minnesota has universal meals with the difference paid for with state funding, the federal government still requires school districts to identify students who are eligible under the federal standards for free and reduced meals. So this is probably an area that occurs beyond just in this bill. It'd probably be good for us to demark this, that they're federally eligible for free or reduced price meals. It's really getting at an income standard, but that income standard is still required, even though for meal purposes in Minnesota, the universal meals pays for all children, regardless of their family income status. So it probably makes sense in 124D111, where we deal with the food programs, to talk about those definitions being for the federal definitions for free and reduced price meals.
Representative Feist.
Thank you. This might be a dumb question, but how do we identify whether students meet those federal definitions without the forms?
Mr. Strum?
Chair Pryor, Representative Feist. Most of the identification in Minnesota is done through direct certification. That keys off of SNAP eligibility, medical assistance eligibility, some other public assistance programs. And so there's a match that's made behind the scenes with DHS and MDE. And that identifies somewhere around, I think last year, about 85, 87% of all students that would otherwise qualify. The remainder are identified through application forms, which are often referred to as the paper applications. And the federal nutrition program, to the extent that the state is still leveraging federal money for nutritional programs, requires that districts also ask that the paper applications be filled out for those who aren't identified through the direct certification or the direct match. So paper applications are still being requested by school districts. These are also used for calculating other things, including compensatory revenue, which is a lot of money for school districts. And some schools use this federal free and reduced lunch standard for things like reduced or free participation in after-school activities and other school events like that.
So in your opinion, this is fine?
Chair Pryor, Representative Price, we should fix it universally, but probably not a problem for Representative Norris's bill.
Okay, thank you.
All right, so you're cleared for now. All right, thank you. Thank you for the discussion. We appreciate the clarification. I do have Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Representative Norris. I think the goal of this bill is fantastic. Getting as many students access and pushing kids is a phenomenal goal. I just have maybe some logistical things to, and we can talk more detail offline, but I think first, just the process of, and I can only speak from my experience in the different school districts I've been in, is when we're scheduling students into advanced classes, we use a process called data triangulation, where we look at multiple data points for enrollment into those classes. So that could be an MCA result, or it is usually MCAs, a growth model assessment as well. So like an NWA or FastBridge, teacher recommendations, and then also the students' grades and content areas. So it's one of the testifiers talked about one data point, and that's not best practice to place kids into accelerated classes based off of that. So just wanted to talk logistically from a process standpoint. And then the automatic enrollment 2 weeks prior to the start of the school year. I think it's important to understand that registration is, for many districts, it has already started or is starting. So what does that look like within registration handbooks? And, so it could be very easy to talk to, whether it's an assistant principal, school counselor in charge of the registration process. That would be a really easy way. Because it does have an impact on section counts and then eventually FTEs. So that's an important piece. Now, realistically, if you have 100 students in a grade level, they have to have a place to go. But it does impact the balance of classes. I love the idea of the bonuses. I think it's a great idea. I think we should be incentivizing excellence. So anything we can do that. I met with a group of teachers on Friday morning, and one of their big concerns was pipeline, was the teacher pipeline piece. I think this is this could be a way to model incentivizing excellence. One thing I noticed, I think it's on page 3, but it's only talking about AP classes, and we had a lot of data, but a lot of students are choosing to not take AP classes because of the test. They don't get the college credit unless they score a certain spot. So CIS classes, PSEO, expanding that would be, I think, a really good idea. And then the last thing, the 15% set aside for administrative costs for MDE just seems high in comparison to other bills. So with that, we can talk offline.
Representative Norris, were you taking notes?
Chair Pryor, Representative Baker, I was taking some notes, but I'm sure I look forward to the opportunity to have a more extended conversation with Representative Baker about this.
All right. Thank you, Representative Baker. Representative Berg.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and also thank you, Representative Baker, for pointing out how important it is to have counselors in our school and sort of boosting my bill. Quick question, Representative Norris. So we know that kids learn in a whole bunch of different ways, and they can be brilliant in one subject and really struggle with another. We also know that they don't test well regardless of their knowledge level on a subject or interest in general. There are just multiple reasons why they don't test well as well. So having said that, I'm just wondering what or if there are opportunities that kiddos in alternative learning centers have to be able to participate and have access for subjects that they might really be good in, but are in some of those different types of environments for learning because maybe being a little less proficient in other areas. When we talk about being inclusive, breaking down barriers and disparities, wondering if there is consideration and or access for kids in kind of those different types of learning environments.
Chair Pryor, Representative Berg, it's an excellent question. I'm wondering if one of our PhDs might be able to help us out with answering that based on what they've seen in other states across the country.
Thank you, Dr. Austin, for returning to the testifiers table. Please identify yourself again. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. Megan Austin. It's a great question. I think what we've seen so far in, and Dr. Hengen can speak to other policies as well, is we in Washington, we found that although the policy was focused on using that proficient test score to identify students, districts took other approaches. And the policy seems to have encouraged them to take just a more holistic look in general at what students they might be missing and to identify additional proficiencies, either through a grade in a prior course. There are some programs out there that survey students and try to gather interest and motivation and other factors like that. So there are other pathways to take. I think I would leave it to you to say what you're looking for here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Not entirely sure that answered the question, but so the automatic enrollment, in my understanding, would not, if they're being automatically enrolled, then a survey wouldn't necessarily happen because people are being automatically put into the programs. Do I understand that right?
Yes, so that's a more holistic approach. I think in terms of like logistics of the policy, there's an identification and then there's an automatic enrollment. So that would be used in the identification phase. It's one organization that I'm thinking of in particular, Equal Opportunity Schools, that has done that. In Washington, for example, we spoke with some district superintendents and they identify, they identify all the students with a proficient test score, but in some districts they also go through the list and flag all students with a B grade or higher on their prior relevant course. And then all of those students would be placed into a more advanced course, and that's the automatic enrollment piece. So there's a process of identifying, and then the automatic enrollment is to say, we're taking that initiative for you to say you should be enrolled in this more advanced version rather than a regular version of that course. And then students may opt out, but rather than the student having to opt in or to say, oh, I really want to take this course, I think I'm the right kind of student, they that is the course that shows up on their schedule, and then they can make a change from there.
We are laying this bill over for further consideration and questions, and as people have strong interests in seeing how it works, and we can follow up, the author will follow up. Representative Mueller.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Norris. Good to see you twice in one day. What in the world?
Great.
I did just have a quick question on the attention of what this was. Also, in your handout that you gave us, it was talking about all students in 11th, 12th grade. One of your testifiers talked about how this was eligible for middle school students. In the language here, it talks about on 2.1, it talks about 8th grade or high school statewide assessment. So I just wanted to know, as I know this is just pilot, and as I completely echo what my colleague Representative Bakeberg said about granting more access, just such an important thing. Is this something, because in your participation definition, it's just as a school district. So were you intending for this to be middle school or just high school or all the way around? Just because in my experience in the classroom, as students are identified earlier, they seem to stay in those accelerated classes for their duration. Sometimes that's a good thing, sometimes it's not. But so it's one of those things where I just didn't know what your intentions were for this pilot program. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Sorry. And I think this is a good issue to follow up with for further consideration, because I think it does deserve more of an in-depth look on that. It's actually one of the questions I was thinking of, too. So, you know, in this, because we are laying over the bill for further consideration and because of time constraints for our hearings today, I just would appreciate, you know, a further discussion on that to answer that question for Representative Newell, if that's working for our author and for our committee members. Because I think that is a very good thing to investigate in this bill.
Works for me, Chair Pryor.
Yes. All right. Chair Youakim.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Norris. Thank you for carrying this bill. This is something that's been talked about for a while, and I personally experienced with my students going through Hopkins High School, even though it was a very, very diverse school, once they got to that AP track, it became way less diverse. I'm glad it's focused on a pilot project. I've seen something similar be very successful in St. Louis Park, but that process and structure seem to provide a lot more support than what's written into this bill for our students. One, they worked with not just test scores, but looking at kids in AVID programs and College Possible that may show the ability to do rigor, but may not test as well. And then also talk to the parents long before auto-enrolling, got the parents and the students to buy in, and actually hired somebody that was in the school to help them just manage the class, make sure they're keeping caught up, and making sure that there was somebody there to help with supports and tutoring. So I think there's a few places in the bill that could be tightened up around that, as well as I'd like to echo what Representative Bakeberg said about college and the school programs. There is a big difference sometimes in geography in Minnesota, who has CIS and who has AP. So you might be leaving some folks out. It might be thought, you know, might be easier if somebody is doing this as a pilot to focus on one subject, that they could really wrap around some supports on that student and provide a little bit more data. I like the data collection, but maybe add on if they've signed up for another class then after that, if it's encouraged them to. My biggest concern is just making sure the student is not only ready, but also supported through the process, because it might be the first AP class they ever take. And the last thing we'd want to do is auto-enroll a child who doesn't have the supports, have them fail, and have them not want to try ever again, and make them feel like they're not cut out for it. Also, wanting to make sure, I know just from being in high schools and married to a teacher and having a lot of teachers in the classroom, when schedules are set, if a student ends up opting out of something auto-enrolled and it's a class for a graduation credit, let's say it's a math class that they need, or AP, maybe an AP class that's in an English arena and they still need that English credit, but there might not be something available at all that hour, that might push them into not having a credit to graduate. So kind of watching the way things are scheduled. I don't know how, you know, you could really focus on that. I would want to talk about some of the, as the education finance chair, about some of the ways the money could be used if we gave a pilot projects. I mean, there's a lot of great things. We've put a lot of money into TOCAT. I don't know if putting money into this pilot project program for kids would also want to expand to teacher training and bonuses, and that might be trying to do a little bit too much within that pilot program. You know, we've had everything we've done around teacher retention with, and I'm going to forget the name of it. I'll remember later when we have master teachers come and observe and there's a bonus involved. It has always been done in conjunction with teachers to figure out how they want that to look like. So I'd want to make sure. And then stuff like I said, the instructional material, when it gets to Ed Finance, there's other avenues for money for that. I'd want the money focused on the kids and supporting the kids. So we can have that discussion later. I kind of threw a lot. I had one question for Dr. Austin when you were studying Washington. Did you see more success in schools that had provided that wraparound support for students than just providing that? Here it says, show them where a tutoring place is. Like, did you get that deep into the data that you saw a difference with that?
Dr. Austin.
Yes, thank you, Representative Yoakum. We were not able to observe at that level of detail what each district or school provided. Our study looked across all of those, I believe it was 72 districts, and looked at the effects across all of those districts. So I'm guessing there was quite a bit of variation in terms of supports provided, but even so across those districts, those are the findings that we had.
And I'm Representative Norris, I know you have really good notes for follow-up and further consideration from our members that we've been contributing. I will go to Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll keep it brief. I think this has a very worthy goal. Sounds like just from lots of discussions here, there are issues to work on. So thank you for doing that. Just a very quick question for one of you is, I know you mentioned the data from other states shows a large jump in enrollment. What does the data show for successful completion? Does that have any specific results?
Dr. Austin?
Thank you, Representative Bennett. We proxied for completion by GPAs, and then we also did, I think to Representative Yoakum's point, look a little bit at subsequent course enrollments, and we find that the policy increased subsequent advanced course enrollments for students with a proficient test score, indicating that they completed and then were encouraged to enroll in another advanced course after that. For the 11th graders who still had a 12th grade year left.
Well, closing remarks, brief closing remarks, and then we'll have further consideration. Mm-hmm. Representative Norris.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Pryor, and thanks to the members of the committee. Again, great discussion, lots of good ideas, and we'll be coming around, both the advocates and me, to kind of gather those and hopefully bring forward an author's amendment in the future and see if we might be able to make this possible this year.
Okay. All right, thank you. All right, and with that, House File 2208 as amended, it's laid over for further consideration. Thank you. Thank you for being with us and your testifiers. All right. Next up, we have Representative Clardy and House File 3363. Well, as we know, Representative Clardy is not a member of this committee, but Representative Berg, would you please motion for House File 3363 to be before us, to be laid over for further consideration? How about Chair Yoakum, would you do that, make the motion?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All right. So House File 3363 is before us, and I think we're ready, no amendments. So Representative Clardy, would you please introduce yourself and begin with your testimony and bill presentation.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. I am Representative Clardy. I'm from 53A. I'm really happy to be here. So House File 3633 makes a lot of sense to me. It's all about accelerating engagement. I think about the time when our kids went home during the pandemic and they were doing their studies at home and maybe didn't last the whole length of the school day, and they figured out how to manage that time, and they also figured out how to engage in other activities to learn. So I'm just going to go over the very high points of this bill, and then I've got some wonderful testifiers. So this bill has three main components. The first one is to expand the definition of hours of instruction by giving schools more flexibility to determine what counts as instruction, to include experiences like community-based activities or asynchronous learning outside of the school, the traditional day, or a work-based learning. And then the second thing is we're going to clarify the criteria for earning credits. So instead of just sitting in a chair or sitting there for a certain amount of hours, it's going to be tied to mastery of academic materials and as their primary measure of determining what the credits are. And then finally, it's going to define and fund personalized competency-based education through planning grants. And this bill codifies the definition of personalized competency-based learning on a broadly accepted national standard-wise.
Will be prepared for your first testifier?
Yes.
To come forward as part of the bill presentation to help you understand the bill. And Cornelia?
Cornet.
All right. St. Anthony Brighton Public Schools. Please introduce yourself for the records and begin.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Chairperson Pryor and committee members. My name is Renee Cornet, and I'm the superintendent at St. Anthony New Brighton Schools, and I'm actually testifying on behalf here of our district, along with our students that I hear from on a daily basis, and I'm also representing AMSD. I really appreciate this opportunity to testify in support of House File 3363, and in my opinion, supports the empowering of student learning, and really student-centered learning. As our on our superintendent council, my students have shared with me over and over again that they want to explore options before they go to college, before they start a career. They want to have some experiences before they enter into that space. And as a district that's like seriously committed to seeing the brilliance in every one of our students, House File 3363 allows our school districts to provide agency and honor to each and every one of our Minnesota students. I want to honor the current law. The law requires that children should be in school for a set amount of time and days. We know that when opportunities that students have to engage with their teachers, their peers, it allows for that acquisition of the knowledge and skills to become the positive contributors to our society, become citizens that our democracy demands. I'm a former social studies teacher. My motivation to speak on behalf of House File 3363 is based on what my child's pediatrician told me. Every child, every person is different. We learn at different rates. These developmentally appropriate differences should not hold a child back from further learning, or it should not prevent a child from being seen as competent and or capable. Let's take a child, age 5, kindergarten. We go to school. And for some reason, in 9 months, every child should learn at the same rate. How is this possible? Somehow it's okay medically for my child to walk at either age or month 9 or even at age 2, and that's okay. But for some reason, if a child is looking at algebra and algebra 1, they need to learn it in 34 weeks, but maybe they learn it in 24, or maybe they need 45. I don't understand why this is a requirement. So the flip side is also true. If they need more time, they need more time. If they don't need the time, they shouldn't have to sit there and wait. I want to address how House File 3363 allows for that student-centered and developmentally appropriate approaches to learning. Clarifying the criteria for earning a credit. Our current law states that students must complete an academic year of study or master the subject matter. All we're asking is that mastery become the option. For example, it's a requirement for all students in the state of Minnesota to master up to Algebra 2 standards. The normal progression in almost all high schools goes like this. 1 year of Algebra 1, then Geometry, then Algebra 2. 3 years, they should have to sit and learn. What if they can do it in 2? What if they need 2.5 years? Should they be prevented from learning more math, more advanced math, or going to pre-calc, or even calculus? Why are we holding them back? The flip side is true, right? Same thing, 45 weeks, maybe they need that. That's okay too, they may need 4 years. We believe that learning should be the indicator. not the time sitting in a seat. Let's expand that definition of hours of instruction. I want to make sure I clearly explain. I believe in schools, right? I believe to ensure citizenship to our republic requires that students are in school. But students can master the standards that our state has required of them. I think they should be allowed to also engage in their passion and their interests if they've mastered those standards prior to the required seat time requirement. We allow our students to utilize PSEO, CT courses outside our classrooms. We want these types of options to be expanded so that pathways can be developed through internships, mentorships, expanded research projects, all while being led and directed by a licensed teacher. Bottom line is, consider House File 3363 because it meets our students' needs and what they're asking and what they need to learn. Thank you.
Next up, I have Superintendent Josh. I think we'll come back to, and we can, I think she would return for a question. Superintendent John Swanson. Eden Prairie Public Schools. Hey, Josh, please identify yourself and begin with your testimony.
Yeah, thanks, Chair Pryor, members of the committee. I appreciate the opportunity to take a couple of minutes today to speak with you about House File 3363. I am Dr. Josh Swanson. I serve as the superintendent of Eden Prairie Schools. I work with amazing teachers and leaders who are doing absolutely wonderful things for students every day, and I'm so proud of the work they're doing. I'm here today because the current language in House File 3363 impedes teachers and high schools' ability to offer high-quality, authentic, and personalized learning. It does not empower them to innovate and offer opportunities and learning that we strive for and that we hear is needed from our communities, parents, students, and business partners. We've been working around the current language for several years, and I've had to say no quite a few times to teachers and staff who want to try new things or have new ideas. And I've had to promote staff to find workarounds for that language to seat time. And what does that look like that Dr. Cornet expressed as well. The proposed language that's in front of you today is a significant improvement and will remove some of those barriers and empower our talented high school teachers and staff members to create the types of educational experiences we want for our kids. You see, the language that currently exists is actually based on the concept of Carnegie units or seat time. Which is actually created in 1906, I mean, industrial age concept. And it's still found in so many places. But even the Carnegie Foundation, you might notice the little familiarity of name there, does not think it's actually the best model anymore. On their foundation site, I'd paraphrase, since 1906, the Carnegie unit or credit hour has served as the bedrock currency of our educational economy. It defines what counts as learning, determines the basic organization of secondary and post-secondary education, and it is increasingly clear that the knowledge, skills, and dispositions needed to succeed in the 21st century economy are not singularly demonstrated through time on task. Tim Knowles, the president, shares that the concept of seat time actually limits the curriculum to just a narrow band of skills that can conveniently be taught in a traditional classroom, sidelines a whole range of essential skills from communication to creativity that require a much more nuanced approach, disregards learning that takes place outside of the classroom, and then ignores the diversity both in students' backgrounds and the different ways that they learn. In Eden Prairie Schools, we found it does just that. We've been really working hard to break down those concepts to really offer deep and rich, authentic, and personalized learning experiences. From an equity perspective, that's meant flexing our schedules and trying to focus our resources where they're needed and when they're needed for our students. When we have high school students that are highly competent in an area and have demonstrated competence, our teachers can move to enriching or introducing more independent activities or opportunities for our students. Sometimes that's within the school, sometimes it's not. Those may or may not count under MDE interpretation right now when we've asked. When students are not demonstrating competency, our teachers want to spend more time one-on-one or in small groups to make sure to provide the supports. And so we run flex schedules to meet those needs, but we're really limited because of the way our current language is and exists. We constantly hear from our students that they want more personalization, support, and independence in ways that are supported by our teachers, but that may not meet the current requirements. The current law requires seat time and impedes this kind of personalization and design. It's not what's best for students or for learning. The new language empowers our teachers and leaders and would have broad support from our students, parents, and community. We've also implemented a broad range of pathways and capstone courses over the past several years. They're built through partnerships with other organizations, and we want each of our students to be able to develop the skills, knowledge, and dispositions necessary for their future. Again, the current law impedes this design and process and innovation that our staff are engaged in. Deep and meaningful learning happens in lots of spaces, places, and at various times of the day. We recently had just a little over a dozen students who came in to present at a public meeting, and they were asked about their capstone course learning and the immense amount of work that went along with it. Students said it was some of the best learning they had during their entire high school experience because they were working with professionals in the field. That didn't necessarily happen during the school day, but it was super rich in engaging learning. And in fact, they talked about it didn't even feel like work at all because it was meaningful and they were connected and it was fun for them. Those are just two examples. The proposed language changes would empower staff to create more of these opportunities, but not required. For schools that just want to carry on and business as usual, they still can, but this opens doors. For systems that want to create new and better learning experiences and outcomes that we desire, it reduces barriers and will help us do this work at the high school level. I often hear from legislators, you know, what can we do? What can we do to reduce barriers or workload requirements and then create clarity? And this one seems to be a really easy one to move us in the direction that we really should be going for our kids and our future. It doesn't cost anything and empowers professionals to do great work for our kids. Thank you for the time.
Thank you, Dr. Swanson. Next up is Dr. Frank Herman, Director of College and Career Pathways, Robbinsdale Area Schools. Please introduce yourself and proceed.
Thank you, Chair and committee members. My name is Dr. Frank Herman, and I'm the former principal of Robbinsdale Cooper High School, and I currently serve as the Director of College and Career Pathways of Robbinsdale Area Schools, and I'm here in support of HF 3363 as well. When we look at the definition of instructional hours and competency-based education, it offers several benefits to not only all of our students, but specifically towards our career and technical educational students. But it also allows us to take a broader look at reinventing ourselves to re-engage the changing needs of our learners. The tailored learning experiences that CBE would allow students to progress at their own pace, as my colleagues have already mentioned, focusing on mastering specific skills and competencies. This approach ensures that students can demonstrate proficiency through personal learning strengths. In other words, building on their assets and not focusing solely on their deficits. The flexible pathways that CBE would allow for students to achieve competencies through the guidance of licensed teachers can demonstrate their skills through various means, such as assessments, projects, or real-world applications that they would be passionate about and allow them to complete these courses and well-aligned with hands-on experiences that we so desire. An example that I like to give in Robbinsdale Area Schools, we have over 30 students currently enrolled in our CNA and our EMT programs. And the difficulty that we have is some of the practicums that students need to complete happen outside of school. And obviously when they do this, this does not allow us to recapture some of that time in order to provide the credit that they may deserve when it comes to our instructional day, when it's based on what we have set up. I guess what I'm getting at is learning doesn't turn on automatically when the morning bell rings, and it doesn't shut off when the afternoon bell releases them for the day. We need to continue that education, those experiences that our students have. In recognition of prior learning, CB also recognizes and values prior learning and experiences where students may have acquired skills through internships, work experience, or prior education. And this would allow them to receive credit for what they already know, as well as accelerate their pathways to completion. Overall, students will benefit significantly from implementation of education, of competency-based education by kind of breaking those barriers of the instructional hours, as it aligns closely with the goals of preparing students for successful careers by focusing on those practical skills, industry relevance, and personalized learning experiences, whether they choose to go to a 4 or a 2-year college, a technical college, directly into the workforce or into the military. We believe that this bill would support us having those experiential educational opportunities for our students.
For your testimony. We have a remote testifier next,
Chris Lindholm from Cook County Public School Superintendent. If you're able to hear us, please unmute and begin with your testimony after introducing yourself.
Thank you, Chair Pryor and members of the Education Policy Committee. Good afternoon. My name is Chris Lindholm. I am superintendent of Cook County Schools. We're a district of about 450 students way up in the northeast corner of Minnesota and on the shores of beautiful Lake Superior. So thank you for allowing me to tune in virtually. For many years, I've been a strong advocate for changing the seat time requirements in Minnesota statute due to how much of a barrier it is to the personalization and innovation called for in education today. I offer two reasons I strongly support House File 3363 that may not have been spoken to just yet. First, the proposed language finally addresses the significant inequity between colleges and the schools or AP classes and then colleges that are taught or courses that are taught by colleges as a PSEO class. It doesn't take long for an astute student to figure out that taking a course PSEO from a college may actually be quite easier than taking a CIS or AP class in high school due to differences in time requirements. The proposed legislation finally levels the playing field and allows Minnesota high schools to align their time requirements with higher education. A second key reason that Cook County schools would be very supportive of House File 3363 is our positive and ever-deepening relationship with the Grand Portage Band of Lake Superior, Chippewa, and the flexibility the language creates for our teachers and band members to collaborate on providing personalized and culturally rich learning experiences for our high school students. This legislation will allow us to work in partnership to cultivate ways for our Indigenous students to demonstrate mastery of Minnesota standards while also deepening their connection to and pride in their native identity. The embrace of competency-based learning in both statute language and funding for planning grants is a significant and strategic augmentation of the Indigenous Education for All Act that was passed just a year ago. It provides a key piece of flexibility needed for teachers in all Minnesota districts to provide the culturally inclusive and personalized learning pathways. So thank you to Representatives Clardy and Verney for bringing this meaningful legislation forward. I strongly encourage moving it forward for more consideration. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your testimony. Next up, we have two public testifiers. First, I have Amy Wallstein from Minnesota Business Partnership, and then after that on deck, I will have Caitlin Snyder from Education Minnesota. And please introduce yourself.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee, and thank you, Representative Clardy, for bringing this bill forward. My name's Amy Wallstein. I'm the Senior Policy Director at the Minnesota Business Partnership. We are a trade association that represents the CEOs and senior leaders of Minnesota's largest employers. And we're looking at legislation this year through dual lenses of, does this make Minnesota more competitive? And does this improve Minnesota's workforce? And I believe this bill does both. The business community, the business world, has moved away from 9 to 5. Folks aren't going to offices like they used to. Performance goals are based on competencies and accomplishments. We've moved away from needing to sit in an office for our 40-hour work week. And I think it's time for the education community to start moving in that direction, too. There's much more flexibility that students can experience in the modern society than when the Carnegie units were developed. We see this bill as strengthening future readiness for students. Students can focus on their strengths and their interests and prepares them for the world of work and for lifelong learning. What we see with the future of work is that people are going to need to have developed critical thinking skills, developed skills-based skills, and then as well as work-based learning. Minnesota started to build some really great tools in the space of work-based learning. We've got youth skills training programs that have enabled students to do things on the job that they never were able to do before in supervised settings. We've got career academies. We've heard a lot about some of the innovative things that school districts have been doing in this space. And this bill expands seat time to include all of those activities so that students can be participating and learning outside of the classroom. I also think this ignites public-private partnerships, opportunities for expanded internships. Businesses are more willing than ever before to bring students and learners into their job sites to go to classrooms and explain what they do in the world of work. It also expands opportunities for mentoring. There's been some recent studies on how important mentoring is for students, especially BIPOC students, as they're getting into their post-secondary experiences. I think I'll also just mention that we've got a lot of labor market pressure here in Minnesota. The business partnership had recently done a study that shows that we're about 170,000 positions short over the next few years. A lot of those are in spaces like healthcare, manufacturing, production, where students can get a start if they're interested in doing so at the high school level. So we think this bill kind of takes a lot of steps in the right direction, and thank you, Representative Clardy, for bringing it forward.
Thank you. And finally, in public testifiers, Caitlin Snyder. Please proceed.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Caitlin Snyder. I am a lobbyist with Education Minnesota. We represent 86,000 educators across the state. I had the opportunity to speak with Representative Clardy yesterday morning about a couple of concerns I'm going to outlay here. And I will say that we have about four or five competency-based education teachers that have been working with Representative Clardy and some of the supporters that you heard from. And competency-based education, this can also be called personalized learning, this can be called project-based learning, it's a couple of different things. And this is something that our members are fully in support of. They want more innovative ways to teach students and let them advance at their own pace. Our concerns with this bill is that sections 3 and 5 are tied to competency-based education, whereas sections 1, 2, and 4 are not. Those are making changes to the overall way that we make academic choices in the state of Minnesota, and we have a complicated system. We have 3 overlaying requirements for our high school students. We have the academic standards that are set by MDE. We have the graduation credit requirements that are in statute and that you're very well aware of. And then we also have the instructional time. So those 3 systems overlap and are very complicated. But by not having the changes tied to competency-based education, you're changing the system for everything. So when we look at language on page 1 that says determines when a student is actively engaged in the educational process, that could be lots of things. That could be a gardening after school program versus a project that you're working on with a teacher. So we've talked with Representative Clardy. We've talked with some of the stakeholders. We think that there's some great work we can do here in the competency-based learning space and would like to focus on those parts of the bill.
So members, as I mentioned earlier, we are going to be laying this bill over, and actually the intent is to have a good discussion on the ideas here. We've heard people advocating for these for a while on what was important and some new ideas that is bubbling up. I think this is our first public discussion of it, and I think the testimony that we heard was really important. So what I'm asking is if you could keep your remarks brief at this point and know that we will follow up. And I think not just with Representative Clardy, but also with the advocates that are bringing forward to see what they're thinking and how they can work with maybe concerns or questions, and then also how we can maximize what we think might be some potential in the bill. So I'm asking if we could keep our comments brief, knowing that we are planning a much follow-up. Did he get his question answered? All right, and I have first Representative Mueller on the list.
Thank you, Chair Pryor. And Representative Clardy, this bill is music to my ears in the sense that as a teacher, I taught like this already. This was something that was such an important thing for me to be competency-based, mastery of skill, those type of things. And so your bill is an indication of a problem that has nothing to do with our teachers and our students. It has everything to do with the bureaucracy that has told us that seat time is in the statutes. It is not in the statutes. And I've looked just to find out, just to make sure. It's not there. So I don't know who's telling them. Well, actually, I can guess who's telling them that seat time is the reason why we have to do this. But it is not. Everything in your bill, which is so amazing, is already able to be done. I looked up all of the things in statute, and I'll go quick, Madam Chair. Statute 124D, this is experiential learning and applied learning opportunities. Talks about project-based learning, work-based learning, Montessori schools, Montessori schools, on and on and on. Already all available to our school districts right now. And that was instituted in 2014. 123B04, talking about site-based making individual learning agreements. This was adopted in 1986. I was in kindergarten when this was adopted. And they're able to look at, demonstrate, and evaluate instructional alternatives to age-based grade progress. We already can do this. 123B, this was adopted in 2009, and this gives school boards, site-governed schools under this authority, they can determine learning model and organization, select and develop its curriculum, and on and on and on. And so as I'm listening to all of our testifiers, this is already available to them. And I am so glad that your bill points out this glaring barrier, that it is not the willingness of our students, it's not the willingness of our teachers, it's not even the willingness of our legislators, it's the willingness of the bureaucracy that tells them no. And I think that that is something that we should address, because it's already available for us to do. And so, Representative Clardy, thank you. I am concerned with some of the things, the inconsistencies that Ed Minnesota brought up with the hours versus competency and all those things. Like, I am concerned about some of that. But I just want, you know, to be very pointed that what you are attempting to do here is admirable, and we should be able to do this. But the barrier is not us. It's not our teachers. It's not our students. It's the people who are telling them no. And they're having authority of saying no when they don't have it. One of the things that your testifier said was, I'm constantly working around MDE's interpretation. It's written in statute. They don't have to interpret anything. It's right there. And so I'm very excited for us to continue to have this discussion, because I know that this will bring to light and open up a lot of doors for our schools so that they can see the authority that they already have to do this. Thank you, Representative Clark, and thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hill. Thank you, Chair Pryor, and thank you, Representative Clardy, for bringing this important bill forward. I think that Dr. Swanson touched on a lot of points that I thought were really timely and clearly, you know, deeply connected to the question at hand here. We talked a lot about empowering school staff, in particular instructors. But I think the key piece for me in looking at programming like this is the way that it can empower our students and empower our students to pick pathways and to pick connections that they have. I wrote my dissertation on a school that engaged in programming similar to what's being described here, not matching, but similar. And what it led to, the findings that I was able to unpack, led me to believe that deeper interest for our students leads to certainly deeper engagement, but at the end of the day, deeper learning. And that's where we really see these impacts begin to explode and multiply and grow. I think for me, my concerns around the legislation have to do with ensuring quality of programming is always going to be something that's a key interest of mine. And also ensuring that there is equal access to programming like this for our students, not just students of a particular institution, a particular school, but around the state. That if we are going to move in a direction such as this, that we have those things in place. Thank you for bringing this important conversation.
Representative Joaquin.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Representative Hill. You touched on a lot of things I was concerned about equal access tonight. But I'm so happy, Representative Clardy, that you are tackling the discussion around hours and when those hours could be spent, because it's something that's been talked about for a long time. I think maybe we could talk about that, move on that, without having to talk about competency-based learning, because as Representative Mueller pointed out, our districts can already do this. and we don't have MDE here to ask whether or not they've denied other schools. We can always get that information later. I don't want to put them on the spot. I do have like some questions, like I actually circled the circled actively engaged in the education process of the district, because I don't know what that definition is either. But I'm sure that you're going to be working with a lot of people to try to make sure this is the best bill possible. And yeah, I look forward to it being worked on and seeing what we could come up with. And if it, you know, does end up coming to education finance, we'll have another fuller discussion about what that money can be spent on. But from what I understand, we have a lot of different statutes that allow districts the flexibility to put these programs in place. When I did tour Rosemount a few years ago, Superintendent Berg's district is Rosemount, right? From this morning? Oh, Farmington, sorry. When I toured Farmington, where was I? I've been doing a lot of schools in the last few years. When I toured Farmington, they have a competency-based model in place. I think it's successful because they did it in conjunction with their teachers and built it out, and they did the education of their parents so they'd understand, because it is different. It's kind of like, you know, when parents had trouble learning lattice math because it was different than what we learned. So if it's a different model, there's a lot of education that comes into place and making sure that your teachers are there every step of the way when it's developed as well. But one of their big things was the questioning around seat time and hours. So I think focusing on that is a really important thing for us to look at. So thank you.
Great. Representative Baker, you are back on the list.
So I would echo everything that Representative Mueller talked about. And I would just go back to, I think, an educator I was talking to, he just said, you know, Ben, we're educators are compliance-oriented people. We want to do what we're told. And so I think when that interpretation happens from the department, that's the heart that an educator is looking at from. They don't want to push back against the department. So they shouldn't have to do workarounds. They shouldn't have to do all that. But I would echo what Representative Hill talked about is we need to be focused on what's best for our kids. We think about this morning in Ed Finance, we heard about what Minneapolis is doing with their pathway program. It's phenomenal. I mean, phenomenal work that they're doing. And it reminded me, you know, the Carnegie units, 1906 is when that all started. And that was during the Industrial Revolution. And in my principal role, as we were educating parents about some of the changes we were doing within our own building, we talked about that factory model of education, and really we're getting back to that. So, Representative Clardy, I love this. And I go back to some of the training that we do in our districts, and we talk about the three R's: relationships, results, relevance. And we could go around the room and have a discussion, but I know we don't have time, about what's the most important thing. And I bet most of us would say, because I did the first time too, that relationships are the most important thing. But when you talk to kids, what they say is relevance. Like, I can have a great relationship with someone, but if what you're teaching isn't connecting with me, I'm not going to listen. So, and that's what I believe this bill does, is it creates opportunities for relevance for our kids. So, with that, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bennett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Clardy, thank you for bringing this forward. It's great legislation. You know, it's obvious that it's needed right now. We need to clarify for schools what they can do, because it's not clear right now, and evidently anyway. It looks like in law we're able to do this, but sometimes we have to make it more clear. So thank you for it. I love it because it's local control and it's innovation. It's going to allow for innovation. It empowers educators. It empowers parents to come up with things to help their students locally. And that's what we need. We need more of that. And I'm looking forward, as a result of this, to models and prototypes that we can then show other districts and say, look how well this is working in Albert Lea, or look how well this is working in Bemidji, and then move forward. So I'm sad that we need to clarify it, but we do, so thank you.
Mm-hmm. And Representative Clardy, closing remarks.
Thanks for listening to the bill. I really appreciate your comments and your willingness to dig into it and, you know, learn more. I think it is important to empower the local decision makers because they see what's going on. And also, we do have a school to visit, and so I'll get back to you on some schools. It's a school district that's already doing this. It's escaping me right now. I was going to announce it today, but so I'd like to invite you out to the other school, and I'll pass it out later. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Flaherty. And you can stay right where you are. And with that, House File 3484 is laid over for further consideration. And we will move on to our last bill of the afternoon, which is House File 3360. So we will have Vice Chair Hill, would you motion to have House File 3360 before us for consideration?
That would be the motion, Madam Chair.
And we will move this. The intent is to re-refer this bill to Education and Finance after today's meeting. So that would be the motion.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. I had to finish reading the sentence there before I called on you. Thank you. All right. Representative Hardy, would you please reintroduce yourself for this bill and begin with your testimony?
Yes, I'm Representative Clardy. I'm from 53A, and I'm excited still to be here. I don't know how you guys do it at this time of day, but anyway, the bill that we have before us, 3360, is addressing driver education grants. So the goal in mind is to help students that are from low income or that qualify for free or reduced lunches. And so that is the purpose. The school districts can offer enrollment in the program if students are between 15 and 19. And I know that at 14 years old that they can start doing some of the preliminary things, but right now we have it at 15 to 19. We're working on the language a little bit. The school may pay for the driver's education provider up to $350 for each student who qualifies for free or reduced meal prices, or I'm sorry, free or reduced meals, and then another $150 for other students. And if there is an additional charge, because I kind of looked at like different programs here and in greater Minnesota and somewhere in greater Minnesota, fees are up to like $500. That's why we have that variance in there. Each year, the Commissioner of Education will reimburse school districts for the total amount paid by the school district for driver education programs. And then the school district must apply for reimbursement in the manner required by the Commissioner of Education. The amount necessary for payment of driver education aid to school districts are annually appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of Education. And there will be a driver's education work group, and the purpose of the work group is to see basically what the landscape is. It will be comprised of a Commissioner of Education, Public Safety, Employment and Economic Development, and they'll form a work group. And each commissioner then can select a representative to be on the committee as well. So the Commissioner of Education must provide support. The Commissioner of Education must provide staff support to convene the first meeting of the work group, and then the work group must study the availability and access of driver education in Minnesota and kind of analyze the geographic availability of courses and identify barriers of courses and look at the participation of low-income students. Again, this piece is geared toward students that are from free or reduced families, and we want to make sure that our roads are safe and so that they're able to get the education that is required on that. So the work group will, the work group that will be prepared will prepare and submit a written report to the committees of the legislature with jurisdiction over education, driver's education, and driver's license by January 2025. And in the report, it must describe the status of the driver's education courses, recommend changes to increase student access to driver's education courses. The report also must recommend permanent funding mechanism to extend the availability of driver's education for Minnesota low-income students. And that is the bill that I'm presenting.
Thank you, Representative Clardy. I believe there are two that we have signed up for testimony. First, I have Pete Hosmer from a driver's ed school. And if you would introduce yourself for the committee and please proceed with your testimony.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chair Pryor and committee members. My name is Pete Hosmer. I own a company called A-Plus Driving School. I also serve on the MITSIA, which is the Teachers Union of Drivers Educators for the state of Minnesota. I'm the vice president of that organization. So covering driver's education, I cover everything, public and private. I also serve on the Advisory Council for Traffic Safety, which is comprised of members of the Department of Public Safety, Department of Transportation, Department of Public Health. And our number one goal is to try to eliminate the number of deaths we have on our roads. And one of the biggest things we found is the more education our drivers have, the better drivers they are. So I won't ask all the people here at these tables how many of you took driver's ed or how many of you remember taking driver's education, but I hope most of you did. I'm here with three quick points, and really my company and the people I represent are on the front lines of driver's education. We are the ones talking to your students. We are the ones answering the phone calls. And I get phone calls every day. Number one, I want to talk about access. I get calls and emails every day from students saying, how can I afford driver's education? The access to the courses is not a problem. We offer classes in person at many of the local high schools and in greater Minnesota. We do Zoom classes that meet three times a day. We now do fully online classes so kids can take driver's ed at any time. But the questions they have are, how am I going to be able to afford this? You know, I direct them to, and I've been doing this for over 20 years, and I don't have one specific place I can direct kids to for funding. Check with the county. The county says check with the state. The state says check with the county. These kids are 15, 14, 15, 16 years old, and that's overwhelming for them. If they're in a family that's on free or reduced lunch, in poverty, or, you know, living check to check, coming up with $450, $500 for driver's education is astronomical, and it's I hear it in their voices on the phone. I guess I'm just not taking driver's ed, Pete. I guess I'm just going to have to wait till I'm 18. We passed last year driver's licenses for all, but it's really not driver's licenses for all. It's for all that are 18 years of age or older. If you're under 18, you still have to take driver's ed, and if you can't afford it, sorry, there's nothing we can do. So think about that access. Number two is safety, and I'll ask you, who do you think are our most dangerous drivers on the road? And you would say, oh, those new drivers, those 16, 17-year-olds. No, they're actually pretty good drivers, and if they've taken driver's ed, obviously they know the rules of the road. It's the 18-year-olds who said, you know what, I couldn't afford driver's ed, so I'm just going to wait until I'm 18, and I won't have to take any classes. I won't have to do any behind the wheel. If I can pass those tests, I can get in a car and I can drive on the roads with all of us. All right, those are our most dangerous drivers. You know, I'm dealing with teenagers who the frontal cortex of their brain isn't even built yet, and I'm trying to explain driver's ed to these people. And if we give a license to someone who's 18 who's still in that process with no training, they are a gun waiting to go off. Finally, why is driver's education important? It's the first step that these teenagers are going to take into adulthood. I asked you all at the beginning, do you remember taking driver's ed? And most of you probably will remember who your instructor was, or maybe if they slapped your hands because you didn't have them at 10 and 2, or maybe you remember who you were sitting next to, but it was one of the main things that you remember in your mind. For people who are in poverty or who are low in the lower class of money, getting their license is a chance for them to get a job and move their family members around and You know, it's it, get a job that it pays a meaningful amount of money to get out of poverty. So I'm looking to put safe drivers on the road. I want safe teenager drivers on the road. And the more safe drivers we can put on the road, the better for all of us. If we're just letting students go by till they're 18 and they get no training, I think that's a crime.
Yeah. Well, thank you. Thank you for your testimony and your enthusiasm for this. Thank you. Good. All right. Finally, we do have Theodore Rose, would be on remote, policy director of the Council of Minnesota, Minnesotans of African Heritage. And I do apologize that we're short on time. So, Ms. Rose, if you could identify yourself and proceed, but perhaps if you can limit your remarks, we would greatly appreciate that as a committee. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. And good afternoon, Chair Pryor and committee members. Thanks for the opportunity to give very brief remarks here. We have submitted written testimony as well. My name is Theodore Rose, and I am Legislative and Policy Director for the Council for Minnesotans of African Heritage, or CEMA. I'm testifying today on behalf of our council and one of our community partners, the East Metro Civic Alliance. And CEMA, we were created by the Minnesota Legislature to amplify the voices of our constituents. We advise government on issues that impact our communities and support their equitable participation in the resources of our state and our economy. I want to thank Representative Clardy for bringing this bill forward, House File 3360, and really ask the committee to support the bill. Income inequality shapes access to driver's ed, as the previous speaker was testifying to, and licensed driving. Teens from wealthier households are more likely to participate in driver's ed. Teens from low-income families are more likely to be prevented from getting licensed because of costs. And that kind of socioeconomic divide also disproportionately impacts Black teens and families. We know that access to driver's ed can increase a student's prospects for enjoying health and wellness, public safety, upward labor mobility. And we know that for all of us, I mean, for most of us, you know, greater access to licensed driving increases access to better quality jobs, housing, health care, education, and food resources, also critical there. Our economy is best served when we invest in these types of resource opportunities, and this bill is a good step in that direction. So please support House File 3360. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for your words. We can turn now to member discussion, and I do hope that you're all able to stay a few more minutes so we can have discussion and answer questions and take a vote on House File 3360. Representative Lee.
Thank you, Chair. I'll be very quick. I want to thank Rep. Clardy for bringing this bill before us, and also just say I will support it. My high school offered driver's ed as a class, but you still had to pay an extra $300 to $400. And so appreciate the effort to make this more accessible.
Thank you. I do remember driver's ed at my age. Representative Bennett, any closing words? Closing remarks, Representative Clardy.
Again, thank you. I just looking at making Minnesota a place where everyone thrives. I think it's an equity issue, and then also that it makes it safer for all of us to drive on the road with trained drivers. So, thank you.
All right. Thank you, Representative Clardy. And with that, Vice Chair Hill renews his motion to re-refer House File 3360 to the Committee on Education and Finance. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Nay. The motion carries, and House File 3360 is on its way to Education and Finance. I think that's it for today. Thank you for making it to the end. Appreciate that patience and the discussion that we've had. With that, we are adjourned.